The final edition Radio Hour is a work of satire intended for audiences who own books, gentrify neighborhoods, and say they like kale. Please consume responsibly, the satire, that is.
Hi, I'm Jeff Chrysler.
And I'm Tony Hendrick. And this is the final edition Radio Hour.
This week, we fix everything. Absolutely everything.
Everything?
Everything. We fix Ferguson, we fix Gaza, we fix ISIS, and we fix Rick Perry.
I'm confused. What do you mean by fix?
I mean, we fix them. We fix them good. We blast them into smithereens.
Oh, I see. You don't mean to imply that we solve any problems. You just mean we just...
I just mean we blast them. Just punch them and kick them and stab them with a knife.
That's fairly violent rhetoric for a radio show, don't you think?
Yeah, well, it's a fairly violent and fairly terrible world, Tony, and frankly, I'm in no mood to just be another stuffed shirt simply talking about the horrors of humanity, whether it's tear gas or police or corruption or the goddamn people at tech support.
They are all bastards. You're right. So, what do you propose we do? How can we, as you say, blast them?
We'll use the weapons at our disposal. We don't have guns, we have funny voices. We don't have money, we have catchy jingles. We don't behead our enemies, we just do passable impersonations of them acting like jerks. That is how we blast them.
Just like the boys in the trenches during the Great World War.
Which we also ridicule.
Well, yes indeed.
So, are you with me, Tony? Shall we fight the good enough fight to save the world?
Will there be profanity?
You're bleeping right there will be.
Then I'm with you. This is
the final edition Radio Hour.
There it is.
I love people. That's why I like to shoot them. Hi, I'm Officer Name Withheld for Legal Reasons. If you're looking for a vacation packed with adventure and human rights violations, why not try Ferguson, Missouri? Here in America's favorite war zone, you can experience life the old-fashioned way, before civil rights, the First Amendment, and disapproval at shooting teenagers. In our little hamlet, you can't say what you want, but with all the tear gas, you won't be able to. And if you don't like the way we treat you, just hold your hands up over your head and see what happens. Missouri has gone from the show-me state to the blow-me-away state. In Ferguson, we can't promise that all of you will be shot 6 times in the torso and the head, just those of you who seem black or otherwise African-American. If you're looking for a Civil War reenactment, go to the South. But if you're looking for a real U.S. war that's not even civil, come to the Middle East or the Middle West. Hey, tourists, over here!
Ferguson Vacation Packages. Ask your travel agent how to avoid getting killed.
Good evening. I'm Brian Celsius, and this is Viewpoint. Tonight, the topic is the Middle East, and I'm pleased to welcome Denise McFadden from the Washington Post.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
Also joining us are Peter Bentworth of the New York Times.
Good to be here.
And Michael Steinberg from ABC News.
Hey, Brian.
Denise, you were just recently in Iraq following the fighting in the northern part of that country as the Kurdish army attempts to defend itself against the extremist Islamic State fighters.
That's right, Brian.
Some are saying the president is going to find himself inexorably pulled into yet another war in Iraq. Do you think Mr. Obama will be able to avoid deepening the U.S. involvement there?
Unfortunately, no, Brian. I don't see how the president can avoid it. This is going to be a life and death struggle that could take a long time to play out.
Looks that way. Peter Bentworth, you spent the last few weeks in Gaza. Any chance of a ceasefire at this point?
Brian, at the moment, things look pretty grim. Israel and Hamas have again resumed firing rockets and missiles at each other, and it doesn't feel like either side is ready to compromise.
No, you certainly got that right, Peter. Michael Steinberg, you spent time in Syria, where government forces are steadily making gains against the rebels. Was President Obama correct to refuse to give the rebels the weapons they asked for?
It's a no-win situation, Brian. President Obama is finding out, as have pretty much all American presidents before him, that when it comes to the Middle East, there are really no good options. No matter what our intentions may be, everything we do seems to make things worse. Like it or not, the Middle East just seems to be a place of endless conflict and death.
Yeah. Man, that's depressing.
Well, it's a complex part of the world, Brian.
Yeah, complex part of the world. More like completely fucking hopeless. wouldn't you say? Peter?
Well, Brian, I don't know that I would characterize it that way.
Oh, you wouldn't, would you? Well, how about if I characterize it as totally pointless bullshit?
You know, Brian, one thing I've learned about the Middle East is that to cover it is a heartbreaking and frustrating experience.
Right, I'm sure it is, Denise, but even just talking about it is no picnic either, okay? I'm so depressed right now.
To pick up on Peter's point about the war in Gaza...
Can we talk about something else? Anything?
Well, Brian, as far as the situation in Iraq goes, on the bright side, the Islamic extremists have been put on notice that they're not going to have the cakewalk that they might have expected.
Yeah, that's great news, Denise. After everything that's happened over there in the last quarter of a century, a few more years of this nihilistic horseshit is just what the doctor ordered. That's awesome!
From a positive standpoint, Brian, the selection of Haider al-Abadi as Iraq's new prime minister certainly seems to suggest greater compromises with the Sunnis.
I said something else, Michael. Not the same goddamn thing. Do you know the difference? Michael? Anybody?
I'm really psyched about the Emmys.
The final edition asks the man on the street, what do you think about the arrest of Texas Governor Rick Perry?
Now look at Rick Perry. I see a great American. The square, handsome jaw. Masculine, lined face. Strong body. Big chest. Strong. Strong grip on him.
I think he should get that Texas Walker Ranger to come and help him do some karate chops.
Everybody just thinks he's stupid based on everything he's ever said.
I just hope he doesn't have to close down Niggerhead.
And when he goes to prison, I'm gonna be his friend in there.
When he's in jail, they're gonna take him by the panhandle.
I still think he has a chance in the presidential race, depending on what he does for the talent portion.
So, you know what the state armadillo is for Texas? It's the armadillo!
The Final Edition Radio Hour now presents the latest installment of Steve's Adventures with Tech Support. We take you to a cramped, darkened one-bedroom apartment located in Hollywood, California, wherein former Daily Show writer and part-time temporary worker Steve Rosenfield is, yet again, attempting to contact Tech Support.
Oh, great. I got a live person.
Thank you for calling Crap-O Wireless Automated Voice System. To begin, please say or enter your 13-digit account number.
Oh, shit. Where did I put that?
I'm sorry. I didn't get that. Please say or enter your 13-digit account number.
No, wait.
Do you need more time to complete this function? Enter 1 for yes or 2 for no.
Okay, I got the number.
That was not the correct entry. Please enter 1 for yes or 2 for no. You have requested more time to complete this function. Please say or enter your 13-digit account number.
1, 2, wait. No, I meant...
I'm sorry, I didn't get that. Please say or enter your 13-digit account number.
Damn it!
It appears you're having difficulty completing this function. You are now being transferred to the next available customer service specialist.
Thank God.
The next customer support specialist will be available in approximately...
4...
Oh, well, that's not too bad.
T-8 minutes.
No!
Forty-7 minutes and 38 seconds later.
Thank you for calling Crap-O Wireless. This is Tyler. How can I help you?
Yeah, my internet doesn't seem to be working properly. I was hoping you could help me with some troubleshooting stuff.
Is this for your mobile device or your computer?
My computer.
Okay, that's a different department. I'm going to have to transfer you. Hold on.
No, wait!
Welcome to This Week in Ferguson. Civil libertarians have requested an autopsy of the First Amendment, which they said was shot at point-blank range by police officers. The final edition takes you there now, where the autopsy is in progress. As you can see, the body of this amendment has six holes of varying sizes. The first two are in the upper thorax, where it says Congress shall make no law establishing freedom of speech. That has been all but obliterated.
These wounds actually build on previous damage caused by police during Occupy Wall Street, several Republican and Democratic conventions, and the WTO protests of 1999.
This section would be unrecognizable to its creators even before Ferguson.
Which brings us to the section below it, freedom of the press.
Ferguson police put holes here, here, and here by going after reporters and telling them to, quote, get the fuck out.
The amendment guarantees the right to say get the fuck out, but not to make the press actually get the fuck out.
You can see here that the amendment may have struggled, knowing it was under attack by officers sworn to uphold it, but constitutional rights are no match for policemen with more unnecessary firepower than RoboCop 1, 2, 3, and the 2014 reboot.
Which brings us to the lower thorax.
Right. There isn't one.
If you look down here, you'll see the right to peaceably assemble is gone.
The hole is so big, there's no evidence that it was ever there.
I had to look it up on Wikipedia just to confirm its language.
Future generations will probably eliminate it from Wikipedia.
Now, while this body has been dead for quite some time, its younger brother,
the Second Amendment,
is alive and well. So, if you want to peaceably assemble, just make sure everybody assembling has guns, because you still have the right to open carry.
The Second Amendment is the new First.
If you want First Amendment rights, you'll have to pry them from its cold, dead clauses.
That concludes our autopsy.
We would take questions, but you no longer have the right to ask them.
Join us next time when our story will be whether paid administrative leave is a sufficient deterrent to murder.
The Final Edition Radio Hour. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Final Edition Radio Hour, satire with teeth.
Hillary, welcome to Martha's Vineyard. I'm glad we can patch up our differences after your unprovoked attack on me in the Atlantic. Hillary? Hillary!
Clam it, oh man. I'm putting distance between you and me.
I understand, but can't we at least be civil?
Civil? You mean like the rights you're allowing to be violated in Ferguson?
Whoa! Low blow, Hillary. Can't we just talk?
If I want any shit out of you, I'll squeeze your foreign policy.
Hillary, please. I know you disapprove of what I did with Syria.
Pussy!
Let me change the subject. How's your drink? Made it myself.
You call this a drink? Clinton's put better liquids on 24-year-old interns' blue dresses.
Hillary! Distance is one thing, but I'd like to end these hostilities.
Like you ended the war in Iraq?
You know I haven't restarted the war. I'm just sending limited airstrikes.
Right, and I'm just on a book tour.
I get what you're doing, but is it necessary to trash my presidency, which you were an integral part of, in order to launch your own?
I'm sorry, did you hear something? Because to me it sounded like blah, 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 blah.
Hillary, I thought you were coming to my vacation to make up, and as your spokesman said, hug it out. But I can see I was sadly mistaken.
I'm sorry. My statements are not intended to attack you, your policies, or your leadership.
Glad we got that straightened out. Cheers!
Asshole!
What?
overly cautious.
Hillary, when it comes to you and me, how about you just don't do stupid shit?
Now that's the first thing I respect you've said all night. But listen, Oprah, if I want any stupid shit out of you, I'll just squeeze John Kerry's head.
Hello, mates. I'm John Oliver, the suave yet sophisticated leader of the British invasion and contemporary American comedy. These are my glasses, this is my tie, and this is my cadence. The British comedy invasion began with Tony Hendra, continued with Monty Python, made a detour with Benny Hill, went off the rails with Mr. Bean, got back on the rails with Billy Connolly, went off the rails with Dame Edna, and said, oh, fuck it, we fucking don't need fucking rails with fucking Russell fucking Brand. Because I'm on HBO and not The Daily Show, I can say fuck in bunch lines that otherwise might not be as fucking strong. Next on our agenda, Late Show host Craig Fuckerson, Craig Ferguson, will be replaced by British comic actor James Corden. You may recognize James from the movie Begin Again if you were one of the three people who saw it. Speaking of beginning again, we will reboot all of American comedy with Brits. New girl will become new bird. Two broke girls will become two skint birds. And HBO's girls will become HBO's cunts. I'm sorry, HBO's fucking cunts. So don't fuck with the British invasion. We have the accents, we have the style, and we're the only ones who fucking know the language. This is John Oliver saying, God save the Queen, she ain't no human being, fee, fi, fum, fo, it's not TV, it's HB fucking O.
That's not even music. It's like aversion therapy.
Thank you for your patience. The next customer support specialist will be available in approximately...
6...
Please just say minutes.
T... 4 minutes.
You're killing me here!
63 minutes and 12 seconds later...
Thank you for calling Crapo Wireless. This is Logan. How can I help you?
Yeah, my internet isn't working. Can you help me with that?
Did you check the automated system to see if there are any outages reported in your area?
No, I was having trouble with that. Say, you don't need my 13-digit account number, do you? I got it right here.
No, sir. Your phone number came up on my system. Can you just confirm your first and last name, first name, last?
Rosenfield. Steve.
Okay, Mr. Rosenfeld, I'm going to have to put you on hold for a moment while I check for any outages in your area.
Wait! No! Not again with the...
Okay, Mr. Rosenstein, it appears there are no outages in your area. Now, first, I need to ask you, is your modem properly plugged in to a working outlet?
Yes! Yes!
Is your computer properly plugged into a working outlet?
Of course it is.
Okay, what I need you to do is pull up your web browser and type in http://www.crapo_wireless.tech.
How can I go to a website if my internet is not working?
Okay, do you know how to locate your web browser, Mr. Frank?
All right, that's it. I want to speak with a supervisor.
Hold, please.
This is Your Business, the business show that gets all up in your business. I'm your host, Craig Atler, and tonight I'm talking to Bob Neff, an expert in the art of interpreting body language. Bob is the author of Your Body Makes Noises, and tonight he's going to tell us how body language can help us in the business world. Bob, it's great to have you here.
Well, I can see you mean that by the way you're sitting. You have a very open posture, arms are at your sides, you're leaning forward with obvious interest. These are all good signs for a successful encounter.
Well, you certainly seem to know your stuff.
I can also tell you're into Tom Petty.
That's probably the posters.
Yes.
So, Bob, when you walk into a meeting, what's the first thing you look for?
Well, this may surprise you, but I look at people's feet. I make some excuse, drop my pen, or pretend to throw up, and look under the table to see which way people's feet are pointing. If they're pointing toward the door, they want to leave. If they're pointing east, that means they want to go to Boston, which is east of here.
What if they're pointing in different directions?
Oh, well, that can take a while to figure out. I once had to stay under a table for about half an hour working on that.
Did anyone ask what you were doing down there?
I told them I was afraid of a moth. They seemed to accept that.
What do you look at next?
The hands. Are they curled in a fist? Are they blocking the face? Are they missing any fingers? That can tell you a lot.
And then you put together a picture and see if your audience is going to be receptive.
That's right. For instance, looking at you, I can tell by your feet and from your hands touching your face that you are totally into me.
I beg your pardon?
I don't happen to swing that way myself, but those are definitely the signals you're putting out.
Mr. Neff, I'm sorry if you got the wrong impression.
It's all right. I'm used to it. Every time I meet a group of people, large or small, at least a few of them are secretly into me.
Every single time?
Oh, yes. But I've learned not to be distracted by it. That would be unprofessional. I pursue those leads later, outside a business setting.
And as a result, are you constantly having sex?
Well, that's the funny thing with body language. People express feelings they don't even know they have. I'll show them what they're doing to lead me on, but they still argue. I mean, why do you argue with science?
That must be frustrating.
It does get lonely, being the only person who knows there's any flirting going on.
One last question. How should I interpret your body language right now?
Well, let's see how much you've learned. Why don't you describe what I'm doing?
You're curled up in a fetal position on my desk.
That is correct.
One hand, you keep pulling at your hair, and the other hand is covering your eyes very tightly.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like it hurts.
It does.
And your feet are pointing east, so you're thinking about Boston.
That's absolutely right.
Well, thank you, Bob Neff, for this fascinating look at body language. That's it for today on Your Business. Come back tomorrow when we get marketing tips from a cult leader.
Hello, I'm Larry Merkin, former University of Phoenix Juris Doctor graduate and now recent medical graduate from the Caracas Institute of Alternative Medicine. So you can also call me Dr. Merkin. Today, I am reaching out to all current female employees of the Hobby Lobby who have recently been denied coverage for birth control. Do not fret, ladies. Dr. Merkin is here for you. I have created an entirely new and holistic form of birth control that no entity will be able to deny you. It is a method I invented by myself with items I found on eBay. I have tested this method on my entire family, including my wife, my two delightful daughters, and a female pet rabbit that my girls named after me, Larry Merkin. We've all been very happy with the results. So, if you would like more information, please contact me at 1-888-MERK-DOC and order your starter kit. Remember, you cannot be denied insurance coverage for this because this method isn't even approved by the FDA.
This has been a privately sponsored paid announcement by Larry Merkin. For Larry Merkin, with the written consent of Larry Merkin. Larry Merkin is not a legitimate spokesperson, nor does he represent anything or anyone other than himself.
With luck, we'll be right back. You are listening to the Final Edition Radio Hour, satire with teeth. Hi, this is Tony Hedro. As you probably know, August 2014 is the centenary of the outbreak of the 1914-18 conflict known in Europe as the Great War. It didn't become known as World War I, of course, until we'd managed another World War, which only goes to show George Santayana was right, and we're probably in for a few more World Wars before the series is cancelled. World War I was a holocaust for the working classes of Europe and Russia. Between the two sides, roughly 15 to 16 million able-bodied men were killed in combat, died as prisoners, or went missing in action.
From all over the map, they were dragged off the land and out of their factories, offices, shops, and workshops, dumped down in a gigantic mud pit in northern France and Belgium, and told to charge the enemy lines, as soldiers had for two centuries. Big difference now, both sides had shiny new 20th century weapons, like machine guns, tanks, long-range artillery, grenades, fragmentation bombs, submarines, chemical WMDs. So-called battles became scenes of unimaginable carnage, as tens of thousands of sons, brothers, lovers, and husbands on both sides were obliterated in rolling mists of blood, flesh, and bone in a matter of hours. If one side managed to move its lines a few inches forward, literally, it was declared a glorious victory. Behind this madness on both sides were commanders who had grown lazy and arrogant over the previous half century, slaughtering indigenous peoples armed with pre-industrial weapons all over the planet. They also tended to be from the upper classes of their respective societies, subscribing to a vicious pan-European class system which regarded anyone who worked with their hands as inferior, dim-witted, and expendable. When it was all over and the victorious British confronted their losses, over a million of their sons, brothers, lovers, and husbands dead and missing, people had to find some good in the vast bloodbath, however futile it had been. Everyone, dead or alive, was a hero. It had been a war that would end all wars. No one was interested in investigating the lunatic callousness of the British commanders, least of all top dog Douglas Haig, a privileged pig-headed monomaniac who'd sent 500,000 young Brits to their deaths, and in the process so weakened his own forces that he almost lost the war. Haig was the Donald Rumsfeld of World War I. As psychopathically incapable of acknowledging responsibility for the horrors he'd caused, and as unlikely to be held accountable for them. Far from bringing him to justice, laws were passed which sealed for 50 years military records of the atrocities British commanders had perpetrated on their own men. Any dissent from the official version was stamped out or poo-pooed into silence. This positive view of the Great War persisted, and as its horrors receded, even amplified. When World War II came along, it became both less remarkable and helped confirm the pathetic conviction that Britain would always prevail. All that changed in the late 50s and early 60s as the US-led race to World War III met massive and noisy resistance from Europe, which had already endured two of them. The anti-war movement in Britain was led by CND, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. CND didn't accomplish much politically, but it did highlight the new lunacy of techno-war, in which as many humans as had died in an entire world war might now die in the first nuclear exchange. Satirists took notice. The legendary British review Beyond the Fringe in 1960 included two significant hilarious sketches. One satirized the absurdities of civil defense drills and measures in the event of nuclear attack, the British equivalent of duck and cover. The other took aim at the sentimental myths that had grown up about British sang-froid and tenacity in World War II. World wars were now satirical fair game. At the same time, in the East End of London, a commune of improvisational actors called the Theatre Workshop had established themselves in the once derelict Theatre Royal. The Theatre Workshop was founded by Joan Littlewood, an unapologetic left-wing provocateur and a director of genius. She was given a collection of World War I songs, bitter, sardonic, and often funny, which had been popular in the trenches among the British rank and file. The authentic words and voices of those expendable millions whom Haig and his generals had so blithely sent to their deaths. With these songs to bind it together, Littlewood and her company began improvising a satirical musical that would rip the lid off the sanctified image of World War I and present its true horror, cynicism, and brutality from the point of view of the guys who actually had to do the killing and dying. It was called Oh, What a Lovely War.
Oh, 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 it's a lovely war.
Oh, What a Lovely War was a perky music hall, or burlesque revue, popular in Britain during World War I. It involved the audience as much as possible, and followed the progress of the war from 1914 on, with sketches and numbers about every aspect of it. The core cast were in period Pierrot costumes, which gave it a macabre jollity, full of pep and patriotism and toe-tapping dance numbers, but over the proscenium was a running readout of the horrific figures that were beginning to come to light. Such as the number of men who were killed on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, 58,000. The one that's always stuck in my mind from the night I saw it in 1963 was Average Life of a Machine Gunner on the Western Front, 4 minutes. But it was the songs that made the show so memorable. First, of course, there was the recruiting song.
We watched you playing cricket and every kind of game.
At football, golf and polo, you men have made your name.
But now your country calls you to play your part in war.
And no matter what befalls you, we shall love you all the more.
So come and join the forces as your fathers did before.
Oh, we don't want to lose you, but we think you ought to go. For your king and your country both need you so. We shall want you and miss you, but with all our might and main, we shall cheer you, thank you, kiss you.
Attention. The outlook isn't healthy, you'll admit. But I have a perfect dream of a new recruiting scheme, which I think is absolutely it. If only other girls would do as I do, I believe that we could manage it alone. For I turn all suitors from me, but the sailor and the Tommy. I've an army and a navy of my own. On Sunday, I walk out with the soldier. Monday, I'm taken by a tar. Tuesday, I'm out with a baby boy scout. On Wednesday, ah, huzzah! On Thursday, I gang out with a Scotty. On Friday, the captain of the crew. But on Saturday, I'm willing, if you'll only take the shilling, to make a man of any one of you.
And as soon as the recruits have been conned into volunteering, they get an immediate taste of what life is going to be like from a sadistic sergeant major, and soon discover the reality of battle. Like several World War I popular songs, this is a parody of the famous hymn Onward Christian Soldiers. Blessing Battles, indeed, was a big part of World War I, as one of the sketches illustrated.
The choir will now sing What a Friend We Have in Jesus as we offer a silent prayer for success in tomorrow's onslaught.
Close.
But as the mountains of dead grow, the average Tommy's job is not just digging trenches, but digging mass graves for his mates who didn't make it. And given the life of horror in the trenches, maybe being in the grave isn't such a bad place to be.
Oh, what?
The bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me. And the little devils come, they sing-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me. Oh, death, where is thy sting-a-ling-a-ling? Oh, grave, thy victory. The bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me.
One of the supposedly heartwarming occurrences of the Great War was the so-called Christmas Truce in 1914, when the two sides in the trenches called a halt to the hostilities and supposedly shared German schnapps in no man's land. Joan Littlewood was having none of this sentimental hogwash.
It was Christmas Day in the cookhouse, the happiest day of the year. Men's hearts were full of gladness and their bellies full of beer. When up spoke Private Shorthouse, his face as bold as brass, saying, "We don't want your Christmas pudding. You can stick it up your
tidings of comfort and joy, comfort and joy. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy."
It was Christmas Day in the Areem. The eunuchs were standing round, and hundreds of beautiful women were stretched out on the ground. When in came the bold bad sultan, and gazed on his marble halls, saying, "What do you want for Christmas, boys?" And the eunuchs answered,
"Tidings of comfort and joy, comfort and joy. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy."
Bravo, Tommy! English cows is very beautiful! Hey, Tommy! Hey! Are you still there?
Yeah!
You drink with us! Yeah?
Yeah!
You like some good Deutsch Schnaps?
That's whiskey!
Yay! Swing it over!
Tomorrow we meet you in the middle.
Aye, the middle of Piccadilly.
It's funny to hear them speaking English.
Yeah, well, they learned it all at school, didn't they? See you in the penalty area. Happy Christmas!
Happy Christmas!
Good night, Jerry.
The war winds to its ineluctable conclusion, victory, but the mood in the trenches mirrors neither the elation at home nor the accolades that commanders can look forward to.
Granny? Granny, what did Daddy do in the war?
And when they ask us how dangerous it was, oh, we'll never tell.
Cushiest job we ever had.
Lovely War was an enormous hit. It moved to Broadway the next year, 1964, and it changed not only people's perception of World War I, it made a lot of the people it was supposed to make mad apoplectic. Sure enough, when it was revived in London this year, a feckless right-wing ass called Michael Gove, Conservative Education Secretary, a British version of Paul Ryan, was quoted thusly. Oh, what a lovely war! Denigrates the patriotism and courage of ordinary British soldiers in World War I. Well, no. The show denigrates thugs like Gove, who are still ready in the name of patriotism and courage to send ordinary people off to kill and be killed. That's how World War III, which many conservatives, most Republicans, and a lot of the US military command, especially the Baptists, think is way overdue, will come about. And perhaps that's inevitable. It might even be a good thing. It might even solve all the planet's most pressing problems, just like the first two did. This has been Tony Hendra for Oh, What a Lovely War. We'll be right back after this with the Final Edition Radio Hour. Welcome back to the conclusion of the Final Edition Radio Hour, A More Perfect Onion. It looks like we might make it after all.
Welcome to Emerging Vocations, where we look at changes in today's job market. My guest this morning is one of the many people who telecommutes, who works entirely out of his home. He is what is called an aggregator and gathers links and content for various web pages. Mr. Bob Trilling, welcome.
Hi. Does my voice sound weird? I'm not used to talking. Talking.
So it must be really convenient to work right out of your home. What sort of advantages are there with telecommuting?
There's no traffic.
Uh-huh.
No office politics. I was never good at that.
Sure.
Bathing is optional.
Right.
Boy, it's bright in here.
And how did you first start telecommuting?
Well, I had another job. God, I can't even remember it anymore. I worked at a newspaper. I was a layout person.
And then you became part of the new economy. So tell us what you do. Walk us through your day.
I get up at noon or midnight. Day and night are kind of the same. Then I get online and look for news stories about the biological sciences. Then I enter them onto a website about the biological sciences. Then I play online games for a while. Then a week goes by.
Boy, waking up late and staying in my underwear all day? That's the job of my dreams.
In my dreams, I'm always walking down a long road and I can't find anyone.
One more thing. What would you say is the best thing about working at home by yourself?
Well, it gives you a lot of time to think about what led up to this.
I never thought of it that way. Mr. Bob Trilling, thanks for talking to us.
Was this real?
This is Fine Finano. I'm the supervisor.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite get that.
Fine Finano. I'm the supervisor.
Well, anyway, I'm having a rather difficult time getting assistance with my internet problem.
All right. Did you check the automated system to see if there are any outages reported in your area?
Yes. I've been through all that already. There's no outages. Everything is plugged in. I just want to get my internet working again.
Okay, did you try shutting the modem down for a moment and then starting it back up again?
No. I didn't do that.
Okay, well, give it a shot.
Yep, that fixed it. Thanks.
Hold on, Mr. Frankincense. I noticed on your file that you don't have the full tech support package. You have the automation-only package.
Automation-only package? I have a file? What does that mean?
That means you can use the automated system for tech support free of charge. However, if you speak with a live person for tech support, there is an additional charge of $19.95.
What? That's insane.
Yes, per call.
So if I only go through the automated thing, then I can avoid paying extra money?
Yes, it's free for up to 3 calls per month. Then for any calls beyond that, there is an additional charge of $3.95.
Okay, I'm pretty sure that's not free.
Per call. But considering that you have been a customer with us for 10 years, and this is your first time using live tech support, I will give you a one-time-only credit on the $19.95 service charge.
Oh, well, that's something at least.
Of $2.50. And would you be interested in upgrading to the full tech support package today? It's only an additional monthly charge of $39.99. per month.
What the...
Great. Please hold for a moment, Mr. Floven Flamen Heining Flang, while I transfer you over to our billing department so they can get that set up for you. Have a pleasant day.
Thankfully, all was not fruitless, and Steve was able to get his internet up and running by the end of the day so that he could post that funny update on his Facebook page about the Nuremberg trials. It got 12 likes. And this has been Adventures with Tech Support.
For the final edition radio hour, Will Durst here with a few choice words about Texas Governor Rick Perry's mugshot. Or to be more precise, his smug shot. In the booking photo, the guy is grinning like a Cheshire cat who just cleaned out the canary department of PetSmart. Perry was indicted on 2 federal counts of abuse of power, which, for a politician, is real similar to being accused of breathing through their mouth. No big deal. He's smirking because he knows there's a better chance of being struck by lightning, holding Charlize Theron's purse full of winning Powerball tickets, than being convicted, and is wearing the charges as a loud red badge of partisan courage, counting on the controversy to jumpstart his rekindled presidential aspirations. Proving, once again, there is no bad publicity. These days, it's all about getting on TV. Further evidenced by the NFL trying to charge musical acts to perform at the Super Bowl halftime show. That's right. The 3 finalists, Katy Perry, Coldplay, and Rihanna, have each been asked to pony up for the privilege of performing and to kick back a slice of their concert tour following the show. A better solution would be to pay we spectators to watch the overproduced lip-synced extravaganza. The Weather Channel has a new reality show called 3 Fat Guys in the Woods, which is exactly what it purports to be. Anybody can be a star. Andy Warhol's future has arrived. Everyone will be famous for 15 minutes. You don't have to be talented or accomplished. Just get your name and face out there. Kim Kardashian's new iPhone app is expected to make over $100 million this year. The goal of the game is to do anything and everything to become famous. It's all about exposure. Of course, in the Midwest, we were taught you can die from exposure. And it couldn't happen to a nicer couple than Rick Perry and Kim Kardashian. And 3 Fat Guys in the Woods. For the final edition radio hour, I'm Will Durst.
The Final Edition Radio Hour is performed at one time or another by Bruce Cherry, Jen Dodd, Jim Earle, Rob Gordon, Tony Hendra, Jeff Hendrick, Kevin Janis, Jeff Chrysler, Barry Lank, John Marshall, Ebby Parker, Rachel Rauch, Steve Rosenfield, Ann Tuchel, and Darby Worley. The Final Edition Radio Hour is written, at one time or another, by Bruce Cherry, Jen Dodd, Jim Earle, Rob Gordon, Tony Hendra, Jeff Hendrick, Jeff Chrysler, David Eskridge, Barry Lank, John Marshall, Ebby Parker, and Steve Rosenfield. The Final Edition Radio Hour is produced by Tony Hendra and Jeff Chrysler. West Coast producer Barry Lank. The Final Edition Radio Hour is edited and audio produced by Greg Russ and Andrew Hammond. This episode's audio engineer was Eric West. The Final Edition Radio Hour is the property of the Final Edition LLC, copyright 2014.